Side 16. The scene inside was indescribable, and remained so until Victor found the blackboard that was used for what was laughingly referred to as the menu. He picked up the chalk. "I'm talking, but I can't hear me," he wrote, and solemnly handed her the chalk. "Me too. Why?" Victor tossed the chalk up and down thoughtfully, and then wrote, "I think because we never invented sound movies. If we didn't have imps that could paint in colour, maybe there would be just black and white here too." They stared at the scene around them. There were untouched or half-eaten meals on almost every table. This wasn't particularly unusual at Borgel's, but normally they were accompanied by people complaining bitterly. Ginger delicately dipped a finger in the nearest plate. "Still warm," she mouthed. "Let's go," said Victor quietly, pointing at the door. She tried to say something complicated, scowled at his blank expression, and wrote, "We should wait for the wizards." Victor stood frozen for a moment, then his lips shaped a phrase that Ginger would not admit to knowing, and he made a dash for the outside. The overloaded chair was already bowling along the street, with smoke billowing from its axles. He jumped up and down in front of it, waving his arms. A long, silent conversation went on. There was a lot of chalking on the nearest wall. Finally, Ginger couldn't contain her impatience any longer and hurried over. "You've got to stay away. If they break through, you will be a meal." "So will you." This was neater handwriting. It was the Dean's. Victor wrote, "Except, I think I know what's happenin'. Anyway, you will be needed if it goes wrong." He nodded at the Dean and hurried back to Ginger and the librarian. He gave the ape a worried look. Technically, the librarian was a wizard. At least, when he'd been human, he was a wizard, so presumably he still was. On the other hand, he was also an ape, and a handy man to have around in an emergency. He decided to risk it. "Come on," he mouthed. It was easy enough to find the way to the hill. Where there had been a path, there was now a broad trail, poignantly scattered with the debris of hurried passage. A sandal, a discarded picture box, a trailing red feather boa. The door into the hill had been torn off its hinges. A dull glow came from the tunnel. Victor shrugged and marched inside. The debris hadn't been cleared right away, but it had been pushed aside and flattened down to allow the crowd to go through. The ceiling hadn't fallen in. This wasn't because of the debris. It was because of detritus. He was holding it up. Nearly up. He was already down on one knee. Victor and the librarian stacked boulders around the troll until he could let the weight off his shoulders. He groaned, or at least looked as if he'd groaned, and toppled forwards. Ginger helped him up. "What happened?" she mouthed at him. "Hmm?" Detritus looked puzzled at the absence of his voice, and tried to squint at his mouth. Victor sighed. He had a vision of the Holywood people stampeding blindly along the passage, the trolls scrabbling at the blockage. Since Detritus was the toughest, naturally he'd play a major part, and since the only function he normally used his brain for was to stop the top of his head falling in, equally naturally he'd be the one left holding up the weight on the hill. Victor imagined him calling out unheard as the rest of them hurried by. He wondered whether to write him a cheery message, but in Detritus's case this was almost certainly a waste of time. Anyway, the troll wasn't about to hang around. He loped off along the tunnel with a grim look on his face, concentrating fiercely on some private errand of his own. His trailing knuckles left two furrows in the dust. The passage opened out into the cavern, which was, Victor now realized, a sort of antechamber to the pit itself. Maybe thousands of years ago, supplicants had flocked out here to buy, what, consecrated sausages, maybe? And the holy banged grains? Spectral light filled it now. It was still full of damp and ancient mould wherever Victor looked. Yet wherever he didn't look, at the edges of his vision, he kept getting the feeling that the place was decorated like a palace with red plush draperies and baroque gold decorations. He kept turning his head sharply, trying to trap the ghostly glittering image. He met the librarian's worried frown and chalked on the cave wall, "Realities merging?" The librarian nodded. Victor winced and led his little group of Holywood gorillas, at least two gorillas and one orangutan, up the worn steps into the pit. Victor realized later that it was Detritus who saved them all. They took one look at the swirling images on the obscene screen, and dream, reality, believe, await. And detritus tried to walk through them. Images designed to trap and throw a glamour over any sapient mind bounced off the back of his rocky skull and came right out again. He paid them no attention at all. He had other fish to fry. The trollish phrase is other maddened grizzly bears to stun. Being trampled almost to death by a preoccupied troll is almost the ideal cure for a person confused about what is real and what isn't. Reality is something walking heavily up your spine. Victor hauled himself back onto his feet, pulled the others towards him, pointed to the flickering, bulging oblong at the other end of the hall, and mouthed, "Don't look." They nodded. Ginger gripped his arm tightly as they inched their way down the aisle. All of Holywood was there. They saw faces they knew ranged along the seats, immobile in the shivering light, every expression nailed in place. He felt her nails dig into his skin. There was Rock, and Murray, and Frontkin from the commissary, and Mrs. Cosmopolite, the wardrobe lady. There was Silverfish, and a row of other alchemists. There were the carpenters, and the handlemen, and all the stars that never were, all the people who had held horses, or cleaned tables, or stood in queues and waited for their big chance. Lobsters, thought Victor. There was a great city, and lots of people died, and now it's the home of lobsters. The librarian pointed. Detritus had found Ruby in the very front row, and was trying to pull her out of her seat. Whichever way he moved her, her eyes swiveled towards the dancing images. When he stood in front of her, she blinked for a moment, scowled, and knocked him aside. Then her expression slid back to vacuity, and she settled into her seat. Victor laid a hand on his shoulder and made what he hoped would be soothing, beckoning motions. Detritus's face was a fresco of misery. The suit of armour was still on the slab behind the screen in front of the tarnished disc. They stared at it hopelessly. Victor tentatively drew his finger through the dust. It left a streak of shiny yellow metal. He looked at Ginger. "What now?" he mouthed. She shrugged. It meant, "How should I know? I was asleep before." The screen above them was bulging very fatly now. How long before the things came through? Victor tried shaking the, well, call it a man, a very tall man, in seamless gold armour. Might as well try to shake awake a mountain. He reached over and tried to free the sword, although it was longer than he was, and even if he could lift it, would be as manoeuvrable as a barge. It was gripped fast. The librarian was trying to read the book by the light of the screen, feverishly thumbing through the pages. Victor chalked on the side of the slab, "Can't you think of anything at all?" Ginger took the chalk. "No, you woke me up. I don't know how to do it, whatever it is." The fourth exclamation mark only failed to be completed because the chalk snapped. There was a distant ping as part of it hit something. Victor took the other half out of her hand. "Maybe you should have a look at the book," he suggested. The librarian nodded and tried to put the book in her hands. She waved him off for a moment and stood staring into the shadows. She took the book. She looked from the ape to the troll to the man. Then she pulled her arm back and hurled the book away from her. This time it wasn't a ping, it was a definite low and very resonant boom. Something could make a noise in the place with no sound. Victor skidded around the slab. The big disc was a gong. He tapped it. Bits of corrosion fell off, but the metal shivered under the light blow and gave out another tinny rumble under his touch. Below it, now that his eyes were instinctively seeking it out, was a 6-foot metal pole with a padded ball at one end. He grabbed it and heaved it off its supports, or tried to at least. It was rusted solidly in place. The librarian positioned himself at the other end, caught Victor's eye, and this time they hauled on it together. Flakes of rust dug into Victor's hands. It was immovable. The gong hammer and its supports had been turned by time and salt air into one single metallic hole. Then time seemed to slow and became a series of frozen events in the flickering light, like moving pictures sliding through the box. Click. Detritus reached down over Victor's head, grasped the hammer by its middle, and lifted it up, tearing the rusted supports out of the very rock. Click. They threw themselves flat as he gripped it in both hands, flexed his muscles, and took a swing at the gong. Click, 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 click. Caught in a series of tableaux, Detritus appeared to move instantly into, click, different but connected positions as he pivoted on one horny foot, the hammer head, click, making a bright arc in the darkness. Click. The impact knocked the gong so far backwards that the chains broke, and it slammed against the wall of the pit. Sound came back quickly and in vast quantities, as though it had been dammed up somewhere and had then suddenly been released to slosh joyfully back into the world and drown every eardrum. Click. The giant figure on the slab sat up slowly, dust cascading off it in slow streams. Underneath it was gold, untarnished by the years. It moved slowly but deliberately, as though propelled by clockwork. One hand grasped the giant sword, the other gripped the edge of the slab to steady the figure as its long, tapering legs swung down to the ground. It stood upright, 10 feet tall, rested its hands on the hilt of the sword, and halted. It didn't look very much different from its posture on the slab, but this time there was an air of alertness about it, a sense of huge energies idly ticking over. It paid no attention at all to the four who had awoken it. The screen stopped its wild pulsating. Something had sensed the presence of the Golden Man and was focusing its attention on him, which meant that it was temporarily removing it from elsewhere. There was a stirring from the audience. They were waking up. Victor grabbed the librarian and Detritus. "You two," he said, "get everyone out of here. Get them out of here fast. Ook!" The Holywood people didn't need much encouragement. Seeing the shapes on the screen clearly without the cushion of hypnosis was enough to make anything brainier than Detritus have a sudden urge to be a long way away. Victor could see them struggling over the seats, fighting to escape from the pit. Ginger started to follow them. Victor stopped her. "Not yet," he said quietly. "Not us." "What do you mean?" she demanded. He shook his head. "We have to be the last ones out," he said. "It's all part of Holy Wood. You can use the magic, but it uses you too. Besides, don't you want to see how it all ends?"
"I had rather hoped to see how it all ends from a long way off."
"Okay, look at it another way. It's going to take a couple of minutes for them to get out. We might as well have a clear run at it, eh?" They could hear shouts in the antechamber as the former audience piled into the tunnel. Victor walked up the suddenly deserted aisle to the back row and sat down in a vacated seat. "I hope old Detritus is bright enough not to be left holding up the ceiling again," he said. Ginger sighed and sat down next to him. Victor put his feet up on the seat in front of him and fumbled in his pockets. "Would you like," he said, "some banged grains?" The Golden Man was just visible under the screen. His head was bowed.
"You know, he does look like my Uncle Oswald," said Ginger.
The screen went dark with such suddenness the inrushing blackness almost made a noise. This must have happened many times before, Victor thought. In dozens of universes, the wild idea arrives, and somehow the Golden Man, the Oswald or whatever, arises to control it, or something. Maybe wherever Holywood goes, Osric follows. A point of purple light appeared and grew faster very quickly. Victor felt that he was dropping down a tunnel. The golden figure raised its head. The light twisted and took on random features. The screen wasn't there anymore. This was something entering the world. It wasn't an image at the other end of the hall, but something frantically trying to exist. The Golden Man drew back his sword. Victor shook Ginger's shoulder. "I think this is where we leave," he said. The sword connected. Golden light filled the cave. Victor and Ginger were already racing down the steps of the antechamber when the first shock hit. They stared at the tunnel's empty mouth.
"Not on your life," said Ginger. "I'm not going to be trapped in there again."
The flooded stairs lay in front of them. Of course, they must connect to the sea, and really it was only a few yards away, but the water was inky black and, in Gaspode's word, boding. "Can you swim?" said Victor. One of the cavern's rotting pillars crashed down behind them. From the pit itself came a terrible wailing.
"Not very well," said Ginger.
"Me neither," he said.
The commotion behind them was getting worse.
"Still," he said, taking her hand, "we could look on this as a great opportunity to improve really quickly."
They jumped. Victor surfaced 50 yards offshore, lungs bursting. Ginger erupted a few feet away. They trod water and watched. The earth trembled. Holywood Town, built of unseasoned wood and short nails, was shaking apart. Houses folded down on themselves slowly like packs of cards. Here and there small explosions indicated that stores of octocellulose were involved. Canvas cities and plaster mountains slid into ruin. And between it all, dodging the falling timber, but letting nothing else stand in their way, the people of Holywood ran for their lives. Handlemen, actors, alchemists, imps, trolls, dwarfs. They ran like ants whose ant-heap is ablaze, heads down, legs pumping, eyes fixed furiously on the horizon. A whole section of hill caved in. For a moment, Victor thought he saw the huge golden figure of Osbert, as insubstantial as dust motes in a shaft of light, rise over Holywood and bring its sword around in one all-embracing sweep. Then it was gone. Victor helped Ginger ashore. They reached the main street, silent now except for the occasional creak and thud as another plank dropped off the half-collapsed buildings. They picked their way over fallen scenery and broken picture boxes. There was a crash behind them as the Century of the Fruit Bat sign slipped off its moorings and thudded on the sand. They passed the remains of Borgel's commissary, whose destruction had increased the average food quality of the entire world by a small but significant amount. They waded through unreeled cliques, flapping in the wind. They climbed over broken dreams. At the edge of what had been Holywood, Victor turned and looked back once. "Well, they were right at last," he said. "You'll never work in this town again." There was a sob. To his surprise, Ginger was crying. He put his arm around her. "Come on," he said. "I'll walk you home." Holywood's own magic, now rootless and fading, crackled across the landscape, looking for pathways to earth itself. Click. It was early evening. The reddened light of the setting sun filled the windows of Harger's House of Ribs, which was nearly deserted at this time of day. Detritus and Ruby sat awkwardly on human-sized chairs. The only other person around was Sham Harger himself, smearing the dirt more evenly around the vacant tables with a cloth, and whistling vaguely. Detritus ventured. "Yes," said Ruby, expectantly.
Nothing," said Detritus.
He felt out of place here, but Ruby had insisted. He kept feeling she wanted him to say something, but all he could think of was hitting her with a brick. Harger stopped whistling. Detritus felt his head twist round, his mouth opened.
"Play it again, Sham," said Holywood. There was a crashing chord. The back wall of the House of Ribs moved aside into whatever dimension these things go, and an indistinct but unmistakable orchestra occupied the space normally filled by Harger's kitchen and the noisome alley behind it. Ruby's dress became a waterfall of sequins. The other tables whirled away. Detritus adjusted an unexpected tuxedo and cleared his throat.
"There may be trouble ahead," he began, the words flowing straight from somewhere else into his vocal cords.
He took Ruby's hand. A gold-tipped cane hit his left ear. A black silk hat materialized at high speed and bounced off his elbow. He ignored them.
"But while there's moonlight and music..."
He faltered. The golden words were fading. The walls came back. The tables reappeared. The sequins flared and died.
Said
Detritus suddenly. She was watching him intently.
Sorry, he said. "Dunno what come over me there."
Harger strode up to the table.
"What was all that?" he began.
Without shifting her gaze, Ruby shot out a tree-trunk arm, spun him round, and pushed him through the wall.
"Kiss me, you mad fool," she said.
Detritus's brow wrinkled.
"What?"
he said. Ruby sighed. Well, so much for the human way. She picked up a chair and hit him scientifically over the head with it. A smile spread across his face, and he slumped forwards. She picked him up easily and slung him over her shoulder. If Ruby had learned anything in Holywood, it was that there was no use in waiting around for Mr. Wright to hit you with a brick. You had to make your own bricks. Click. In a dwarf mine miles and miles from the loam of Ankh Morpork, a very angry overseer banged on his shovel for silence and spoke thusly.
"I want to make this absolutely clear, right? One more, and I really mean it, one more, right? Just one more hi-ho, hi-ho, hi-ho out of you bloody lawn ornaments, and it's double-headed axe time, okay? We're dwarfs, goddammit, so act like them, and that includes you, Dozy."
Click. Make My Day, Call Me Mr. Thumpy hopped to the top of the dune and peered over. Then he slid back down again.
"All clear," he reported. "No humans, just ruins."
"A place of our own," said the cat happily. "A place where all animals, regardless of shape or species, can live together in perfect..."
The duck quacked.
"The duck says," said Call Me Mr. Thumpy and Die, "it's got to be worth a try. If we're going to be sapient, we might as well get good at it. Come on."
Then he shivered. There had been something like a faint tang of static electricity. For a moment, the little area in the sand dunes wavered as in a heat haze. The duck quacked again.
Not Mr. Thumpy wrinkled his nose. It was suddenly hard to concentrate.
"The duck says," he wavered, "the duck says quack."
The cat looked at the mouse.
"Meow,"
it said. The mouse shrugged.
"Squeak,"
it commented. The rabbit wrinkled its nose uncertainly. The duck squinted at the cat stared at the rabbit, the mouse peered at the duck. The duck rocketed upwards. The rabbit became a fast-disappearing cloud of sand. The mouse tore over the dunes, and feeling a lot happier than it had done for weeks, the cat ran after it. Click. Ginger and Victor sat at a table in the corner of the mended drum. Eventually Ginger said, "They were good dogs."
"Yes," said Victor distantly.
"Mari and Rock have been digging through the rubble for ages. They said there's all kinds of cellars and things down there. I'm sorry."
"Yes.
Maybe we ought to put up a statue to them or something."
"I'm not sure about that," said Victor. "I mean, considering what dogs do to statues. Maybe dogs dying is all part of Holywood. I don't know."
Ginger traced the outline of a knothole on the tabletop.
"It's all over now," she said. "You do know that, don't you? No more Holywood. It's all over."
"Yes.
The patrician and the wizards won't let anyone make any more clicks. The patrician was very definite about it."
"I don't think anyone wants to make any," said Victor. "Who's going to remember Holywood now?"
"What do you mean?"
"Those old priests built a kind of half-baked religion around it. They forgot all about what it really was. That didn't matter, though. I don't think you need chants and fires. You just need to remember Holywood. We need someone to remember Holywood really well."
"Yeah," said Ginger, grinning. "You'd need 1,000 elephants."
"Yeah," Victor laughed. "Poor old Dibbler," he said. "He never got them either."
Ginger moved a fragment of potato round and round on her plate. There was something on her mind, and it wasn't food.
"But it was great, wasn't it?" she burst out. "We had something really amazing, didn't we?"
"Yes.
People really thought that it was good, didn't they?"
"Oh, yes," said Victor somberly.
"I mean, didn't we bring something really great into the world?"
"No kidding."
"I didn't mean that. Being a screen goddess isn't all it's cracked up to be, you know," said Ginger.
"Right."
Ginger sighed.
"No more Holywood magic," she said.
"I think there may be some left," said Victor.
"Where?"
"Just drifting around, finding ways to use itself up, I expect."
Ginger stared at her glass.
"What are you going to do now?" she said.
"Dunno. How about you?"
"Go back to the farm, maybe?"
"Why?"
"Holywood was my chance, don't you see? There aren't many jobs for women in Ankh-Morpork. At least," she added, "none that I'd care to do. I've had 3 offers of marriage from quite important men."
"Have you? Why?"
She frowned.
"Hey, I'm not that unattractive."
"Oh, I didn't mean it like that," said Victor hurriedly.
"Oh, I suppose if you're a powerful merchant, it's nice to have a famous wife. It's like owning jewelry."
She looked down.
"Mrs. Cosmopolite says, can she have one of the ones I don't want? I said she could have all 3.
"I've always been that way about choices myself," said Victor, cheering up.
"Have you? If that's all the choices there is, I'm not choosing. What can you be after you've been yourself as big as possible?"
"Nothing," said Victor.
"No one knows what it feels like."
"Except us."
"Yes."
"Yes."
Ginger grinned. It was the first time Victor had ever seen her face shorn of petulance, anger, worry, or Holywood makeup.
"Cheer up," she said. "Tomorrow is another day."
Click. Sergeant Colon, Ankh-Morpork City Watch, was awakened from his peaceful doze in the guardhouse over the main gate by a distant rumbling. A cloud of dust stretched from horizon to horizon. He watched it thoughtfully for some time. It grew bigger and eventually disgorged a dark-skinned young man riding an elephant. It trotted up the road to the gates and lumbered to a halt at the city wall. The dust cloud, Colon couldn't help noticing, was still on the horizon and still getting bigger. The boy cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted,
"Can you tell me the way to Holywood?"
"There ain't no Holywood anymore, from what I hear," said Colon.
The boy appeared to consider this. He looked down at a piece of paper in his hand. Then he said,
"Do you know where I can find Mr. C.M.O.T. Dibbler?"
Sergeant Colon repeated the initials under his breath.
"You mean throat?" he said. "Cut me own throat, Dibbler. Is he in?"
Sergeant Colon glanced at the city behind him.
"I'll just go and see," he said. "Who shall I say wants him?"
"We've got a delivery for him, C.O.D.'
"Cod?"
hazarded Colon, glancing at the lowering cloud.
"You're herding fish?"
"Not fish!"
Huge grey foreheads were becoming visible in the dust. There was also the very distinctive smell you get when 1,000 elephants have been foraging for days in cabbage fields.
"Just hang on," he said. "I'll go and fetch him."
Colon pulled his head back into the guardroom and nudged the sleeping form of Corporal Nobbs, currently the other half of the keen-eyed fighting force that was ceaselessly guarding the city.
"What's that? You seen old Throat this morning, Nobby?" "Yeah, he was in Easy Street. Bought a jumbo sausage surprise off him."
"He's back selling sausages."
"Got to. Lost all his money. What's up?"
"Just take a look outside, will you?"
said Colon in a level voice. Nobby took a look.
"Looks like... would you say it was 1,000 elephants, Sarge?"
"Yeah, about 1,000, I'd say."
"Thought it looked about 1,000.
"Man down there says Throat ordered them,"
said Sergeant Colon.
"Get away. He's going into the jumbo sausage thing in a big way, then."
Their eyes met. Nobby's grin was evil.
"Oh, go on," he said. "Let me go and tell him, please."
Click. Thomas Silverfish, alchemist and failed click producer, stirred the contents of a crucible and sighed wistfully. A lot of gold had been left behind in Holywood, for anyone who had the nerve to go and dig for it. For those who hadn't, and Silverfish wouldn't hesitate to put himself first among that number, there were the old tried and tested, or to put it another way, tried and repeatedly failed methods of wealth production. So now he was back home, picking up where he had left off.
"Any good?" said Peavy, who had dropped in to commiserate.
"Well, it's silvery," said Silverfish doubtfully. "And it's sort of metallic, and it's heavier than lead. You have to cook up a ton of ore, too. Funny thing is, I thought I was onto something this time. I really thought that this time we were on the way to a new, clear future."
"What are you going to call it?" said Peavy.
"Oh, I dunno. It's probably not worth naming," said Silverfish.
"Ankh more porkery?
Silverfishium?
Not leadium?"
said Peavy.
"Uselessium, more like," murmured Silverfish. "I'm giving up on it and going back to something sensible."
Peavy peered into the furnace.
"It doesn't go boom, does it?"
he said. Silverfish gave him a withering look.
"This stuff?" he said. "Whatever gave you that idea?"
Click. It was pitch dark under the rubble. It had been pitch dark for a long time. Gaspode could feel the tons of stone above this little space. You didn't need any special doggy senses for that. He dragged himself over to where a pillar had smashed down into the cellar. Laddie raised his head with difficulty, licked Gaspode's face, and managed the faintest of barks.
"Good boy, Laddie. Good boy, Gaspode."
"Good boy, Laddie," Gaspode whispered. Laddie's tail thumped once or twice on the stones, then he whimpered for a while, with longer and longer pauses between the sounds. Then there was a faint noise, just like bone on stone. Gaspode's ears twitched. He looked up at the advancing figure, visible even in utter darkness, because it would forever be darker than mere blackness alone could manage. He pulled himself upright, the hairs rising along his back, and growled.
"Another step and I'll have your leg off and bury it," he said.
A skeletal hand reached out and tickled him behind the ears. There was a faint barking from the darkness.
"Good boy, laddie."
Gaspode, tears pouring down his face, gave Death an apologetic grin.
"Pathetic, isn't it?"
he said hoarsely.
"I wouldn't know. I have never been that much of a dog person," said Death.
"Oh, come to that, I've never really liked the idea of dying," said Gaspode. "We are dying, ain't we?"
"Yes."
"Not surprised, really. Story of my life, dying," said Gaspode. "It's just that I thought," he added hopefully, "that there was a special death for dogs. A big black dog, maybe?"
"No," said Death.
"Funny that," said Gaspode. "I heard where every type of animal had its own ghastly dark spectre, what come for it at the end.
No offence meant, he added quickly. I thought there was this big dog that trots up to you and says, OK, Gaspard, your work is done and so forth. Lay down your weary burden, style of thing, and follow me to a land flowing with steak and offal.
No, there's just me, said Death. The final frontier.
How come I'm seeing you if I ain't dead yet?
You're hallucinating.
Gaspard looked alert.
Am I? Sure.
Ooh, good boy, laddie.
The barking was louder this time. Death reached into the mysterious recesses of his robe and produced a small hourglass. There was almost no sand left in the top bulb. The last seconds of Gaspard's life hissed from the future to the past. And then there were none at all. Death stood up.
Come, Gaspard.
There was a faint sound. It sounded like the audible equivalent of a twinkle. Golden sparks filled the hourglass. The sand flowed backwards. Death grinned. And then, where he had been, there was a triangle of brilliant light.
Ooh, ooh, good boy, laddie.
There he are. Told you I hear barking, said the voice of Rock. Good boy, here boy.
Caw, am I glad to see you,
Gaspard began. The trolls clustering around the opening paid him no attention at all. Rock heaved the pillar aside and gently lifted Laddie up.
Nothing wrong that time won't heal, he said.
Can we eat it now?
Said a troll above him.
You defective or something? This one heroic dog.
Excuse me.
Good boy, Laddie.
Rock handed up the dog and climbed out of the hole.
Excuse me,
Gaspard croaked after him. He heard a distant cheer. After a while, since there didn't seem to be much of an alternative, he crawled painfully up the sloping pillar and managed to drag himself out onto the rubble. No one was around. He had a drink out of a puddle. He stood up, testing the injured leg. It'd do. And finally, he swore.
Woof, woof, woof.
He paused again. That wasn't right. He tried again.
Woof.
He looked around, and colour drained out of the world, returning it to a state of blessed blacks and whites. It occurred to Gaspard that Haga would be throwing out the trash around now, and then there was bound to be a warm stable somewhere. And what more did a small dog need? Somewhere in the distant mountains, wolves were howling. Somewhere in friendly houses, dogs with collars and dishes with their names on were being patted on the head. Somewhere in between, and feeling oddly cheerful about it, Gaspard the Wonder Dog limped into the gloriously monochrome sunset. About 30 miles turnwise of Ankh Morpork, the surf boomed on the wind-blown, seagrass-waving and sand-dune-covered spit of land where the Circle Sea met the Rim Ocean. Sea swallows dipped low over the waves. The dried heads of sea poppies clattered in the perpetual breeze, which scoured the sky of clouds and moved the sand around in curious patterns. The hill itself was visible for miles. It wasn't very high, but lay amongst the dunes like an upturned boat, or a very unlucky whale, and was covered in scrub trees. No rain fell here, if it could possibly avoid it. But the wind blew and piled the dunes against the dried-out bleached wood of Holy Wood Town. It howled its auditions on the deserted backlots. It tumbled scraps of paper through the crumbling plaster wonders of the world. It rattled the boards until they fell into the sand and were covered. The wind sighed around the skeleton of a picture-throwing box, leaning drunkenly on its abandoned tripod. It caught a trailing scrap of film and wound out the last picture show, snaking the crumbling, glistening snake across the sand. In the picture-thrower's glass eye, tiny figures danced jerkily, alive just for a moment. Click, 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 click. The film broke free and whirled away over the dunes. Click, 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 click. The handle swung backwards and forward for a moment, and then stopped. Click. Holywood Dreams.
That is the end of Moving Pictures, written by Terry Pratchett, and it was read by Nigel Planer.